Hello and welcome to Data Driven, the podcast where we explore the emerging field of data science. We bring the best minds in data, software engineering, machine learning and artificial intelligence. Now here are your hosts, Frank Lavinia and Andy Leonard.
Hello and welcome back to Data Driven, your podcast where we explore the exciting world of data science, machine learning and artificial intelligence. With me as always is Andy Leonard. How you doing, Andy?
I'm doing well, Frank. How are you?
I'm doing great. We're recording this on March 22nd, and Andy and I caught up in person at SQL Saturday Richmond, where I got to see your latest presentation.
Yeah, that was a fun presentation, a little out of the ordinary, because I left my power supply for my laptop at home, and this is an oldish laptop. So the battery is long past the useful stage. And it surprised me. It stayed up for about 30 minutes. And then I put on my dancing shoes and finished the rest of the talk with a blank screen.
You handled it very well. As someone who's been an evangelist and presented for a living as well as for the community, that is every presenter's worst nightmare. And you handled it very well. It almost seemed like it added to the presentation.
Well, I really appreciate you saying that, Frank. You weren't the only person that told me that. I was kind of shocked by the feedback. I was expecting people to run out of the room, pausing only to throw something heavy and blunt. But they didn't. And I got your feedback and a couple of three others. And there were maybe, 20 people in that room. So interesting, you know, interesting stuff, and it's data science related, as we talked about. My talk is on automating data integration, which when we speak about that in the context of data science, it's wrangling or munging, but it's the same stuff, same old stuff. So got to get that data ready to be consumed by whatever fancy schmancy engine we're going to load it into that's going to tell us all the cool things.
That is a consistent theme in data science in terms of it taking 80% of the time to actually get anything useful done.
Yeah, that's crazy. But it's not unusual. I mean, we've seen similar metrics when doing old-fashioned data warehousing projects. So it's just a very labor-intense, time-intense project, building either the ETL or nowadays more likely ELT solutions. And that data still needs to be collected, validated, often cleansed, put through some sort of reshaping process, and then it's ready to be consumed by whatever the engine is, whether it's one of these nice new, Azure machine learning or some of the deep learning tools that are out there, or whether it's just a good old Kimball Star Schema data warehouse.
Interesting stuff. We could talk for an hour on this alone, but today we have a very special guest. We have Lynn Langett. Lynn Langett is a cloud architect, Amazon Web Services community hero, a Google Cloud developer expert, Microsoft MVP, and author for lynda.com. And over a million people have watched her Hadoop fundamentals courses online. And I have to say, I've been going through it, and it is awesome. Lynn is a former Microsoft evangelist, and she's been doing a lot of great things in the big data space, as well as a director and lead courseware author for TKP, or Teaching Kids Programming. So she's doing a great job in terms of data solutions, as well as prepping the next generation of data scientists. Welcome to the show, Lynn.
Hey, hi to you guys, and thanks for inviting me to come on.
No problem. I'm excited to have you. Your Lynda courses are really great. I enjoy them. And I actually watch them on my big 65-inch TV, thanks to my Roku.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. I'm actually working on some more. And just to be accurate, lynda.com has been bought by LinkedIn. So it's now lynda.com/LinkedIn Learning, which has been bought by, ironically, Microsoft.
Nice. So it all kind of comes full circle. Just when you think you're out of the Microsoft game, they pull you back in.
Pretty much, yeah.
Now, you're one of the few people, you're an AWS community hero, an MVP, and a Google cloud developer expert. I mean, you hit all three. You're a triple threat.
Yeah, I think actually, you know, not to toot my own horn, but I think I'm actually the only one in the world that has all three. So
nice.
Yeah, so it's really great for my customers. You know, I'm an independent consultant and an architect, so I, you know, design systems and solutions and build stuff. And, you know, part of the value I bring is I have pretty deep technical knowledge. You know, I don't work at any of those companies, but pretty deep. And I'm able to go across the different platforms and, you know, kind of cut through the marketing BS and help my customers understand what's good from each of the platforms. So that's, you know, one of my sort of big value props right now.
That's really cool. So what do you do day to day? I know you travel a lot, and you even book your next trip from the airplane.
Yeah. So I split my time about 50% production, and production could be anything from doing a strategic competitive analysis for a vertical like education and saying, you know, how do you capture your students' behavioral online information and make that actionable and write that report up for the C-levels in a company, to actually sitting with developers and not only building POCs, but actually building production code. I do try to at least get my hand in some production code once a year for about a month or so, because I think even though I do mostly architecture for production, that if you don't actually code, you're kind of full of it. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah. There are a few things more dangerous in the IT world than the non-coding architect.
Exactly. So I like to say I'm a coding architect. So I do that, and then about the other half of my time approximately, it's around technical education. Now, that could be, you know, making courses for LinkedIn Learning. It could be developing and delivering customized training for teams more and more remotely, because it's just not practical. I always travel for a short training situation. And then I've been doing quite a lot of conference speaking. Most notably, I just came back a couple weeks ago from QCon London, where I had the great fortune to actually share the keynote stage with Mark Thompson, who is a luminary of distributed systems. He was very kind, and we did a keynote about lifelong learning in terms of, it's called Engineering U. So the idea was to talk about lifelong learning and to talk about learning from the history of our industry. So that was a really great experience.
Interesting. So would it be fair to say you have a passion for kind of the online learning space?
Just learning in general. You know, I think that, you know, and it's very related to what's happening in data science, because, you know, I like to say I'm a reformed DBA in some ways, even though it was more from an education point, because I was a Microsoft certified trainer for more than 10 years. And I did some production then, but it was more training. But that was, you know, completely in the enterprise SQL Server space. And, you know, it was just a totally different world, but it was, the rate of change was pretty, I don't know, gradual or measured. And since I've left Microsoft in 2011 and become independent and moved from DBA world into big data world, the velocity of change because of cloud and because of the new ways that we collect data, mostly through IoT and you know, devices, has just really upended the whole industry. So you kind of have to be a lifelong learner or you're not going to be employable, you know?
Lynn, I'm curious, can you give us any generic examples or cleansed examples of some of the types of projects you're working on?
Oh, for sure. So, you know, when I first left Microsoft in 2011, I was doing a bunch of, they call it lift and shift, onto the Amazon cloud, because they were the most mature cloud at that point. So I was doing a bunch of small, really in effect, data marts or data warehouses on Redshift, because Redshift, you know, $1,000 a terabyte, and it's SQL compliant. People would call me and they'd say, I need Hadoop. And none of them really did, because they didn't have skills and they didn't have the data volumes. So I did that for a couple of years, just various verticals. I live in Southern California, so I kind of, you know, again, further subdivide my time, 50% startups, 50% enterprise, because there's a bunch of startups in SoCal, most of them media related, in Silicon, Silicon Beach. So like the next Snapchat wannabe or whatever like that. And so I get a lot of big data work there. So it's like aggregate social data kind of thing. So I've done some of that. And that got me working on some Hadoop projects, because that was true big data. Then, most recently last year, I actually coded for the whole year because the project was really interesting. And I was the lead architect, and I worked with a team on an enterprise IoT cloud project. And I wanted to do it, and I stayed because it was so interesting to take this .NET shop that was coming out of on-prem and Windows apps and C# and move them onto Amazon, because that's the vendor we chose, Node, Node Tools, plus they're an Agile shop, so they do TDD, BDD, they do continuous deployment. So in other words, when they check in their code, it pushes all the way out to the Amazon cloud. And that was like super interesting, you know, so I did that. And then the latest thing that I'm working on now, so my sort of focus area is working with the bioinformatics community to help both the research and the commercial communities get faster feedback from genetic sequencing for cancer genomics. And it's fascinating. I've got a couple different groups I'm working with. I did a trip to Australia in February to speak at a bioinformatics conference, and that kind of kick-started that work. Actually, the way it really, really started is I got an email from Google, being a GDE, like an MVP, and they said that this community that I ended up speaking at needed, you know, technical help to be able to literally Dockerize their tool. And I said, oh, I got that. And then I said, oh, there's a conference. Oh, I want to go. Oh, I could speak. And I got accepted. And, you know, that's how these things happen.
That's wild.
Nice. So not only are you a triple threat, but you're also working to cure cancer.
Well, that's I'm working to support the biology community, because, you know, that's a whole different thing. You know, it's kind of cool because I have one child. She's actually an adult now. So my daughter just turned 18, and when she was 17, she had a really good opportunity. She went to Stanford for the summer as a high school student in residence. And she wants to be a bioinformatician. And that's one of the reasons I'm doing this, because she took cancer genomics at Stanford at 17. And so, and it's a regular class. So she's my biology reference for this.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
So what exactly is bioinformatics for folks that may be new to the term?
Oh, for sure. Well, you know, it's a broad term, and I don't even think I probably have the most accurate definition. But for the work I'm doing, what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to help researchers who are getting the results of that DNA or you know, sequencing. So you have tissue, whether you're standard genome, or you sequence more commonly now because the cost of sequencing is actually coming down. Clinicians are able to, if you have cancer, take part of your tumor and sequence that to see if it matches the type that's expected. For example, if you have breast cancer, when you sequence your tumor, does the DNA match a reference genome for breast cancer? Because one of the opportunities in treatment, because sometimes cancers are not what you expect, is if you have cancer A in region, you know, B, then you can treat for the cancer it actually is, and can get a better result. I mean, there's been stories of miraculous cures that actually were people, like there was a guy at Illumina that they make the sequencers, who got cancer, sequenced his own, it was supposed to be prostate cancer, I think, and it wasn't. It was some other kind of cancer. No, none of the treatments were working, and once he sequenced his own tumor, he got treated for the type of cancer it was, and he basically had a death sentence, and his cancer immediately was, you know, basically eradicated, and he's totally healthy. So, I mean, that doesn't happen with everybody, but the fact that it's possible, and the fact that when my daughter came back from Stanford and said, hey, Mom, these people, you know, don't know as much about the cloud as you do, I said, well, there you go. You know what I mean? So
that's awesome. I mean, that's a great example of how big data and data science is changing lives and saving them.
Well, that's my dream. I mean, it's been really cool. The secondary thing that happened in Australia is I got introduced to this professional organization called CSIRO, and they do all the bioinformatics along with lots of science in Australia. And they had built a really advanced pipeline, because what I had seen with the bioinformaticians, they were just like any other people that we work with, is, you know, they're pressed for time. And so their idea for the cloud, other than this one group, is just, well, it doesn't work on my server or desktop, so I'll just get an EC2 instance. But these guys at CSIRO, they had built a serverless pipeline using Lambda, and Amazon published their reference example. I can give you the link so your people can look at it.
That's great. I'll put it in the show notes.
Yeah. And I said, okay, I want to meet these guys because they know what's going on. So I went out there and met them when I was in Australia and talked to them about some of the newer Amazon services like AWS Batch, which helps to make it easier for you to do batch processing, which the bioinformaticians will do if they get, like, they want to try out, like, could it be this genome? Could it be that genome? They're kind of like exploring, but because the amount of data is so huge for bioinformatics, it's 3 billion data points for each sample. They really, truly need Hadoop. You know, they need big data, right? So they need cloud scale. So anyway, so I went out there, and they actually have this library that they wrote on top of Spark as well, which is, you know, Hadoop in memory. It's called Variant Spark. And I'm actually working with them right now to get it out kind of more into the broader bioinformatics community, because it could help bioinformaticians to leverage big data because it's written in domain-specific language. It's written for a biologist. So, you know, like g.process biome, or you know what I mean? Like they wrote the API, so a biologist can use it. So it's been really cool. I'm actually working with the commercial company around Apache Spark, which is Databricks, because they have the implementation that includes IPython notebooks. And
interesting.
Yeah, and those are much, you know, they're interactive. I mean, if you've not seen them before, if you're listening in, it's like a website, and it has you know, just regular text, but most importantly, it has little blocks of code, and then it has visualizers. And so it's more consumable than just like looking at an API library in GitHub. And so I've been working with Dr. Bauer from Cicero and her team, and we actually have a notebook out that we're working on, and we're trying to, you know, test it and make it so her library can be used, because, you know, they're way ahead understanding how to use Spark. Like, I haven't found too many just people generally that know how to use Spark, much less bioinformatics people. So I'm basically kind of trying to be an evangelist for her work, you know?
Interesting. Well, once you've been an evangelist, evangelism is one of those things that's kind of in the blood. You can't stop it.
Isn't it?
And you tend to do it whether you get paid to do it or not.
Right? We are just talkers. Like, when we see,
right.
when we see something that's great technically that can make a better world, we just feel compelled to explain it to people.
Absolutely. Maybe you should get your own podcast.
So to answer your question very concisely, I went from doing lift and shift into the cloud, you know, kind of traditionally, you know, data warehousing and stuff like that, into behavioral capture for around ad tech, and then I did an IoT project, and then most recently bioinformatics. So that's what I'm doing.
That sounds like a lot of fun, and my goodness, the impact that could have. You know, that's just incredible. So hats off to you. I'm glad you're working on that. I can't wait to learn more about it. You know, eventually we're going to figure this out, right? We're going to be able to cure cancer.
Well, that's a dream. You know, if you listen to the guy who runs Illumina out here in San Diego, and that's one of the reasons I got inspired to do this. A couple things, you know, as you age, unfortunately, more and more people around you get affected by cancer. My best friend actually got cancer, and she's going to be okay, but she wasn't able to get personalized treatment. And so the impact of the treatment, you know, was just, I said, you know, this is just unacceptable. Like, we, especially out here in LA, there's so many people that work on what I consider sort of stupid things, like making, you know, the ads appear more quickly on your timeline, which, okay, fine, there's money around that. But, like,
right. And,
you know, I went to meet these bioinformaticians, and they were saying, yeah, you know, we send our data and then we wait like 2 days for processing. And I just said, no, you don't. Because if we don't have to wait for ads, then our bioinformatics people should not have to wait for cancer sequencing results. Like, we need to work on that.
Absolutely.
You know?
Yeah. No, I hear you. You know, it's one of those things, as like Branson describes, as doing good and doing well. You
yep.
know, it's, you can do both, and, you know, not trying to throw off on the people trying to make the ads appear faster. And I know you're not either, but when you kind of put things in the balance, I would say saving lives trumps that.
Right. 100 years from now, whether or not you saw an ad for, you know, some ridiculous product in 2 milliseconds sooner is not going to matter in this cosmic scheme of things. But if you start saving lives and or making people's lives who do have cancer a lot easier, that has a lasting impact.
Right. Well, you know, the other thing about it is, you know, it's a time in my life. My daughter's going off to college, and so I can kind of do whatever I want. I've had a very good career. And one of the reasons that I am doing this and talking about it, even though I haven't, like, personally, you know, written a library or produced, all I'm doing is, and maybe I shouldn't say all I'm doing, but what I'm doing is I'm amplifying very great work from bioinformatics community, is I kind of want to use myself as a personal example of, you know, if you've been in a situation where you're successful, because I do so much education, I do get a lot of contact from people that are maybe watching my LinkedIn courses going, you know, I've been a DBA my whole life, or I've been, you know, a database developer, and now all these new technologies are coming out, and I don't know what to do, and all this kind of stuff. And it's sort of a lifelong thing with me has been to learn new technologies, go and do something good. And maybe you won't even get paid in the beginning. It doesn't even matter. Because what you'll do is you're gonna grow, you're gonna learn something new, you're gonna make a better world, and then the money will come. I mean, I know it sounds kind of Pollyanna-ish, but like I have really seen this over and over and over. You know, dive into the new technologies. The biggest thing that I want to sort of model for people, because you know I'm middle-aged, is that it's just BS that you can't keep learning. I mean, like this is a story that I, you know, I'm very open about. I didn't have very much math education when I was growing up, just kind of a long story, but so I needed to fill in my math knowledge, because when you get into data science and when you get into, you know, you try to do machine learning, you have to know math, you have to know statistics, you really should know calculus. So I never had these things. So I, at 50, 51, I had an injury on my foot and I was laid up for 6 months, and I just made a personal decision. And I did math 3 hours a day for 6 months. I started with the Khan Academy, you know, the thing that, you know, for K through 12 kids. And I built my math and I did the calculus. So I learned calculus at 51. And now when I'm trying to understand these, you know, new optimizations of neural networks that are applied calculus, guess what? I can get it.
I'm sorry. What's cool about hearing, you know, you saying that, you telling that story, others who are in a similar situation, and nobody knows it all, right?
Right.
And maybe they're our age. I'm a little north of 50 myself, and I'm also going through the data science curriculum. And you know, a lot of this I've seen before, but I'm still learning stuff. And I would say I'm learning some really interesting stuff as we go through this. You know, I'm hoping that people will see folks like the three of us, who are all engaged in continuous learning. And, you know, we're older than 40, some of us older than 50. And it's a great thing to share with folks, you know, because there's a lot of the workforce, like you said, that either because of their desire to change careers or, and unfortunately, some are being forced into changing careers. You know, they would love to just have the confidence that, you know what, this is possible. And not only that, but that, look, that person did it. So I'm really glad you shared that.
Yeah, I think the worst phrase in the English language is you can't teach an old dog new tricks. And I think that is definitely not true. I have dogs. Some of them are older. And if they can find a way to steal food or do something that gets them what they want, they have no problem learning it. So and I took math in high school and college, and I despised it. Whereas now, as I go through the data science curriculum, I actually kind of like it, and I see the purpose to it. And I think that I think self-learning is great because, you know, improving yourself and investing in yourself is always a sound investment. And we now live in a time and age where you can just type into YouTube, you know, how do I do this? And you'll get 100 videos on, you know, anywhere from, you know, how do you create a neural network to how do you change a light bulb.
Well, I think too, and you know, because I live in California, I think I kind of see this more than many people. You know, one of the reasons that I'm being really open about this, because like it's a big deal for a person in tech and a woman to say I am over 50. That is a big deal, and I really, you know, carefully consider that. It takes a lot of confidence. But I feel like that is something that our industry needs, because our industry, the innovation in our industry is thought to come from Silicon Valley. And Silicon Valley, of course, is the land of 25 to 35-year-old white and Indian guys, pretty much. And, you know, that is just such a limiting thought that I want to be part of a larger group of people that contribute to tech. I think that, you know, people who have experience, who are continual learners, well, I know from, like, well, the team that I worked on, for example, at the IoT project, that's one of the reasons I went to that team, because their dev team was skewed a little bit older. And, you know, a lot of these, you know, problems, a.k.a. Uber, for example, that we have out with the tech industry are because we have just a subset of people making tech. We need to have, you know, a more full representation of all the people that we have. And in order to get that, those of us who are underrepresented need to be visible. It's tricky because, you know, you don't want to be annoying and always tooting your own horn. That's going to, you know, get old really quick. But on the sure. same hand, it is, I think, very important to make the industry be more mature.
Absolutely. And you know, there's always that balance of tooting your own horn too much. But the other counter argument is, if you don't toot your own horn, you're gonna be waiting a long time for someone else to do it for you.
Right.
For sure. Well, again, when we were in London, Martin and I were talking about, when we were discussing our keynote, you know, we were talking about just how different industries, and one that is sort of interesting, came to maturity is the airline industry. So the airline, and I've studied some of the history of the airline industry, you know, when it first, you know, gained popularity and everybody was able to fly, there was like all this series of spectacular accidents and problems because there was this cowboy mentality of only, you know, basically young guys could fly planes, and, you know, there wasn't a maturity to the industry. And then because of the cost of mistakes, there were different kinds of people brought in, cognitive scientists, to help the industry to figure out how to make, you know, the whole processes more open, how to include more types of people, and how to learn from mistakes, how to grow up, basically. And I think that we're at that point in our industry, and I think that it's particularly important because as more and more data becomes available, this is a critical time because, you know, it's affecting our privacy, it's affecting our, you know, our rights, our access to healthcare. So we have to, it's like a moral imperative, actually, to get more participation in our industry. It really is. I mean, you know, I'm sounding all doom and gloom here, but it is the future of our world
not even that. I mean, algorithms run our day to day.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, 10, 20 years ago, only people who cared about algorithms were computer science professors.
Right.
Whereas now, anything from traffic lights to what ads you see on Facebook are all determined by algorithms.
Right, and again, we've had some really spectacular failures. I mean, you've probably heard about the VTech, you know, data leak of all the children,
yes,
pictures and all. So that's one of the reasons that I did the IoT project, because I'm really interested in appropriate levels of security. You know, not draconian or, you know, security that isn't you can't even use it because it's too much overhead, but actually realistic security, because the IoT, you know, part of our industry justifiably has a horrible reputation. And, you know, I found out some really, you know, really bad things, like hotels that, you know, had the same key for every guest key and every master key. That was a really common thing where
not to mention what came out of WikiLeaks recently.
Exactly, right? And so, you know, having people who have, you know, lived a bit more so they can not just try to, you know, get the startup going and cash it out, can understand, you know, what could be the implications if you don't have proper security about some of this data, I think is like super important, you know?
No, absolutely. Well, I think the being aware of the consequences of your actions or your engineering decisions is something that takes time to develop.
Exactly.
And you know, certainly you're not going to have that type of insight at 25 as you do necessarily at 50.
Wait, you can't. It's impossible. I mean, or rare. It's very rare. Let's put it that way. So.
Well, even still, if you did have someone who was that wise at 25, that person at 50 will be, you know, wiser than the average 50-year-old.
You'd hope.
You hope. Yes, yes. Somebody once told me that, you know, aging is kind of guaranteed. Gaining wisdom is not.
Yeah.
And this is the point in the show where we thank our sponsors who make Data Driven possible. You know, on Data Driven, we talk a lot about data science, machine learning, and artificial intelligence. But did you know the hardest part of any data science related project is data integration? Data scientists often call data integration data wrangling or the icky word munging, but it's all about making sure the analytics engine that you're using has valid and clean data. Enterprise Data and Analytics specializes in data integration and can help your enterprise build better data integration solutions faster with best practices and automation. Enterprise Data and Analytics offers training and consulting services for SQL Server Integration Services, SSIS, and Business Intelligence Markup Language, or BIML. Visit entdna.com to learn more. Enterprise Data and Analytics. Data, it's in their DNA.
Yeah, I mean, you know, again, like looking at, that's another reason to get into the biological data. Like, I don't know if you guys have done this, but I've actually had my genome sequenced. I did the 23andMe. And I did it twice because I'm an old DBA and I wanted to see if it was really legit and see if I got the
good call.
Right? But I wouldn't let my daughter do it because I feel like right now we're swimming in the sea of data and our skills haven't caught up. So we have privacy and security by obscurity in a lot of industries, bioinformatics being one of them. But I feel like by the time she's an adult, unless we can, you know, align our laws, she could possibly face, you know, insurance discrimination because of her, you know, results of her genetic sequencing. And so I've told her, nope, don't do it. Don't do it until the laws catch up, you know?
Well, that was one of the things I was going to bring up. I was kind of in the generic context of dangers about how this data is used. As we're recording this, they're debating. I'm in Virginia, Frank's in Maryland. They're debating in between us about healthcare legislation, and some pieces of that have to do with whether or not the insurance company gets access to your genetic sequence.
Exactly.
And that's on the floor right now. And when I read that, it kind of stunned me, but you're exactly right. I mean, there can be either a higher premium or a different premium or even different access to services or required services because of your genetic data. And it's that just, you know, we just never had that problem before.
That's my point.
Maybe it's the cynic in me. I'm surprised it's taken that long.
Yeah.
For this to be legislated, either for, well, legislated that it's, you know, they can have access to that. Where I think right now it's kind of nebulous.
Right.
Yes.
So you mentioned that security is not really a big deal in bioinformatics. So is bioinformatics, is that covered under HIPAA? Is that something that has to be considered?
No. Let me correct that. That's not what I meant to say. So that is not the case at all. I have not found that to be true. I have found that the researchers are very aware of appropriate security. What I'm saying is for data that's being used by research, there is, to my understanding, there is very good control. However, as more data becomes more generally available, the case that we were talking about just before that, where the legislation is pending, it's not the bioinformaticians. They're fine. It's when other people can have access to your data. So literally your genomic data could be like your credit card data. It could be bought.
Right.
That's the case. So it's not, research is fine. Research is fine. Let me be clear on that. So another area that makes me think about this, since we're kind of talking about this stuff, is I like to use myself as a test case because I feel like, you know, I'm out in front here and I can learn from this. Is all the home devices and all the voice recording devices. So I have every, you know, I have the Amazon Echo Dot, I have an Alexa, I have a Google Home, I have, you know, I use Google Voice on my phone, and it's interesting to see where the data leaks. Sometimes I'll do experiments. I'm such a nerd. where I'll just say things that are wrong. Like I'll talk about my pet dog, and I don't have a dog. And then I'll see where it leaks through. Because voices are being recorded, and our voice information is being sold. And this is a new, you know, again, I'm not trying to scare the heck out of people, but we have to accept the reality, and then we have to move forward appropriately. I see too many people when I demonstrate this that they just get freaked out. And it's like, hey, people, it's already here. So we have to decide what we want to do about it. You know?
Exactly. Yeah, it's not like they're going to stop tomorrow.
Right.
You know, somebody's going to say, oh, look, this thing happened. There's a funny XKCD comic, number 1807, where someone walks in. I've got it pulled up here. And they say, you know, thanks for inviting us. And then Alexa order 2 tons of creamed corn. And then Alexa confirmed purchase. just check that one out, 1807. And it's exactly what you're talking about. You know, they're listening. Apparently, you know, the government has been listening for some time, if the reports are to be believed, that were leaked in the past few weeks. And, you know, not only that, there's listening that we're aware of.
Right.
You know, things like the dots and the Alexa systems and the voice commands that are out there. The home security stuff, Lynn, has been an issue for me for a while. It's not the intended consequences that worry me about this. And I want Frank to jump in here because he has a lot of really good thoughts on this. It's the unintended consequences. And I kind of draw these up in a matrix with four quadrants. And there's, you know, the intended, what you intend, the intended good, and the intended, you know, maybe the intended bad that you're prepared to live with. And then there's the unintended of both those, right? And that unintended consequences quadrant is the one that just scares the dickens out of me.
Well, exactly. And I think, you know, there's two things I want to add to that. I mean, you know, a lot of these companies will say, well, when you agree to the EULA, the end user license agreement or terms of service, well, you knew this would happen. But I mean, realistically, who really reads all that? And I think there needs to be something in plain English that says exactly what they're going to record. But I mean, you're right. I mean, there's things that, you know, there's what we know and what we don't know, and things that we don't know that we don't know. And who knows what's going on with this? Because there used to be a time where you could say, well, if they're really collecting that type of voice data, there's no way they can manage or process that. Well, now we live in a time where that is, you know, not only doable, but accessible to the common person.
Right. Yep. And so, again, that circles back to really what I feel is the obligation of our generation to continually educate ourselves, not only for our own employment, but actually because we are the gatekeepers of the data for our world. And so I feel that by us diving in and taking a look at what are the capabilities of, let's say, machine learning on the cloud, we can have some understanding of what could be done with the data. And we can then take a balanced look and say what should be done with the data.
Sure. The other side of this that I just saw someone post on in the past couple of weeks was how easy it is for, you know, people with malicious intent now to spin up all of this computing power and, you know, and use it basically as a hacking engine, if you would, or a cracking engine. And so there's that as well. So, goodness.
Or even have the webcams turn against a particular website and launch a DDoS attack. I mean, it's scary times.
Well, but again, you know, what do you do? You educate. So it's interesting. So when I was in the production project on the IoT, you know, Cowboy developers, they put up a database server on Amazon, and they didn't put it in the VPC, and it started being used for Bitcoin mining from a foreign IP address within 5 minutes.
Oh, wow.
I had one where I was doing a production, I was doing a perf testing on the Google Cloud. So we had a pretty beefy cluster. It was like 20 servers for database performance validation, and it was set up by that company's engineers, and they didn't, again, it's a common theme, they set it up, they didn't put proper boundary security on it, and Google, we got a phone call from Google. It was very exciting. It was taken over for Bitcoin mining. So, you know, so I've seen these things and they happen really fast. Like they happen within hours, minutes or hours. There's a great tool out there that I use myself and I use it with my customers. It's called Shodan, S-H-O-D-A-N, Shodan.io. I think it's .io. I'll give you the exact URL for the link.
Okay. We'll put that in the show notes.
Yeah, it's a search engine for like Internet of Things and webcams and that kind of stuff. And the guy who runs is John Matherly, and it's also an API. So he has a free version, and I used it with a lot of my IoT customers. Like one, it was great. We put the company name in, and we found devices, and these were commercial devices for device control. I won't say what any more than that. But we found a bunch of devices directly connected to the public internet. And, you know, nothing like that to help the customer to understand why they need to improve their security. Because these were like major hotels, and people could have taken over some of the systems in the hotels.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And you just casually walk into the security discussion and, you know, they're, oh, we have great security. And you pull up a Shodan search and they go, oh, yes, we don't.
Everybody has great security until they're breached.
Yeah. Well, I've done that. I mean, that's kind of been a tradition with me. I started, gosh, way back when it was a Microsoft trainer. And I used the book, you guys will probably know this, Hacking Exposed. And I'm not a hacker, but that's kind of how I learned, right? And then I taught a class in that. And I said, you know, if I, as a suburban mom, can just, you know, read using Wireshark your traffic and your, you know, your unencrypted, you know, passwords or whatever else you're doing wrong, well then, gee, come on, you know?
You know, right.
Let's work a little harder on this. So I've always had this sort of nose for security. I'm not a security expert, but I try to, I call it common sense security. And, you know, as we move to true big data, I think that's serving me well as an architect, because that's that maturity, right? I don't just go, well, pick this cloud, use this hot technology. It's like, okay, let's look at the entire system, you know?
Right. No, that makes a lot of sense. Well, I want to be respectful of your time, Lynn. So where can people find out more about what you're up to and how to reach out to you?
So I'm really active on Twitter. So just my brand is my name. So Lynn Langit, L-Y-N-N-L-A-N-G-I-T. So Twitter, I have a blog, I have a SlideShare, I have over 150 videos on YouTube that are free. I have my LinkedIn classes. I always joke that if you cannot find me, you are not looking.
Well, there you go. Our privilege and honor to have, you know, someone who's a triple threat and doing some great work, not just in data science, but in improving people's lives.
Great. Well, thanks for having me. I really enjoyed it.
No problem. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Lynn.
Thanks for listening to Data Driven. Don't just listen. Become a data driver by going to datadriven.tv to sign up to join the community, access to special events, tips and tricks, and more. Sign up today at datadriven.tv.